What skills or therapies or interventions do they find more effective in the MPN patients?
So I think the thing is about recognizing that we very rarely cure a patient with our current therapeutics of MPN. And so we have to be realistic that their patient is going to live with their disease. And so you have to make a lasting change, not just a short-term change. It's not just about work with it, you know, after you finished your radiotherapy, in 3 months or so, you'll be feeling better. We know these patients are going to go on taking their medication. So it's a little bit about coming to terms with that. But it's also about actually recognizing that the patients with MPN probably are a bit fitter than many patients with solid oncology conditions. And often the patients, in my experience, that complain of fatigue the most are the younger patients. And so we have to be able to devise something that's more appealing to them. So, you know, we have yoga classes. We also get our patients to use Tai Chi. And I think both of those interventions are useful on many different levels. So there's the sort of exercise component, the fact that that exercise is often suitable to slightly less fit people. But there's also the sort of mindfulness meditative component to those interventions as well, which I think addresses some of the kind of mood disorders that can go along with these conditions, but also helps the patients to focus more on themselves.
I think it's really interesting, and I could imagine that in many cases it's overlooked and physicians are not necessarily aware of the magnitude of the problem that the patient might be experiencing. I was interested in terms of what you were saying about, you know, maybe cytokine release. Any thoughts that in any way could be paraneoplastic in some way?
Yeah, so your question about whether the fatigue and inflammation might be tied in and might be paraneoplastic, I think that's really, really interesting. And I think there are several schools of thought there, actually. So the interesting thing is that we see fatigue even in patients with what we think is very low risk disease. So, you know, I see it in my young female patients where I'm even thinking, do I need to give this patient aspirin? They've got the CALR mutation, they've got ET. The way we're thinking about that at the moment is, do I really need to give this patient aspirin or not? And yet these are the patients, we think they've got less severe disease, but they've got terrible fatigue. Whereas we can conceptually see that that might be the case for patients with more severe end of myelofibrosis. I think it could be paraneoplastic and it could well relate to sort of JAK-STAT activation or, you know, other mutational effects. But I really think right now we don't well understand that. And I know that colleagues are, for example, trying to look at correlating cytokine levels with severity of fatigue. We did a study recently in ET patients and we're able to look at the molecular profile of patients and their symptom scores, and also looking at allele burden and symptom scores. And I can't tell you the answer to that because we're still analysing that data, but I think it's really interesting. I think the other really important piece of evidence that cytokines may well be involved in fatigue is the benefit of JAK inhibition with drugs like ruxolitinib. That drug affects JAK1 as well as JAK2. We know from the work of Verstovsek and others in the 251 study, which was the phase 1-2 study of this drug in myelofibrosis, we can see the cytokine heat map really. There's a massive switch off of these inflammatory cytokines. Yes, there's an increase in EPO and an increase in leptin, but otherwise, the inflammatory milieu is completely altered by this drug. And maybe that's one of the ways that this drug improves fatigue for patients. But I would just kind of caution against thinking that ruxolitinib is the answer to fatigue, because I think it really isn't. You need a multidisciplinary approach. And that's where we and others, for example, use the fatigue services, think about psychology and look at other factors, because we often find there are other factors for these patients, unfortunately, that are at play.
I was going to ask you, what happens when you give a drug like ruxolitinib to somebody with low volume, you know, like you said, borderline indication to treat, but with fatigue? Does the fatigue get better?
Yeah, so I think this is something that's really important to measure. So if you're thinking of using ruxolitinib for a patient whose predominant symptom is fatigue, not really sweating or pruritus, and they don't really have the massive splenomegaly. I think here you have to really, really weigh up the risk-benefit analysis of using that drug. And you have to be able to measure, in my view anyway, the fatigue for that patient. Sometimes it really helps, and sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes, interestingly, this afternoon I was talking to a patient actually who's got pruritus, which is a little bit atypical for these diseases. It's not aquagenic. So it made me think maybe it's not linked to his disease, but he's tried almost everything else for it. So what I said to him was, okay, well, we'll give you a try with ruxolitinib, but if it doesn't work and we're not really looking to use the drug for any other indication for you, then we will take you off. So I think having a way to measure it, and that's very tricky with fatigue, for your patient measuring the impact. Helpful sometimes to have a next of kin, like a spouse, in the room when you're asking the patients about how they are and trying to correlate changes.
This may seem like a strange question, but just came into my mind, which is, what happens if you give corticosteroids to a patient with either fatigue or any of the other MF symptoms?
So we have tried corticosteroids, and there's a very nice publication recently from the group in Barcelona looking at the impact of corticosteroids on symptoms and other features of the disease, because, of course, remembering that anemia and thrombocytopenia can be immune in nature, and we're well used to treating these immune disorders with corticosteroids. In my experience, I usually give steroids to patients after I've tried everything else. So I'm trying them on my difficult patients. They often don't have a very good benefit for the patient, but it's worth a try for some patients. After, though, I think you've tried something more conventional.